Alcohol in any number of applications has been intricately woven into human history. For example, in totally separate cultures all around the world, some form of fermented beverage is a familiar part of everyday life. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about the various forms of alcohol and why it and how the kind we drink affects our bodies and our brains, leading some people to become addicted to it. Joining me now are Dr. Ruben Gonzalez, professor of pharmacology and toxicology at the University of Texas, Austin, and Dr. Henry R. Kranzler, professor of psychiatry and genetics and developmental biology at the University of Connecticut Health Center. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Dr. Gonzalez, as I understand it, the word alcohol comes from Arabic, al is the definite article the, and kohl is a powder used as an eyeliner and an antiseptic. And Bartolomeo Traherne, in his 1543 translation of John Vigo, introduces the word as a term used by barbarous Moorish authors for fine powder. Now, can alcohol be a powder?
No. Alcohol is definitely a liquid.
So what do you think happened there? How do you think it came to apply to the chemical formulations we identify as alcohol today?
Well, I'm really not sure about that historical basis. But when it's distilled and purified, it can be used to extract chemicals from other natural plants, for example, and then you end up with a residue as a powder. So, I mean, that's a guess, but I'm not really sure.
Well, is alcohol a family of substances? Because I know we can drink alcohol, but if we drink wood alcohol, we're going to kill ourselves.
You're absolutely correct. So alcohol really refers to a number of different chemical substances. And the one we drink is just one particular structure of this family, and yet, right, as you said, wood alcohol is a totally different chemical structure, and it is very toxic.
Well, alcohol can be used as an antiseptic, as a fuel, as a solvent, a preservative, as something that we drink. What do they all have in common so that they all wind up being called alcohol?
Well, again, it depends on which specific chemical you're talking about. If you think about a single chemical structure, for example, ethanol, which is the one we drink, it can actually have a number of these different properties. But wood alcohol may also do the same thing as also something like isopropanol, which we more commonly think of as rubbing alcohol. So they share a number of properties, but because of their differences in chemical structure, they also have different effects on the body as well.
Now, we drink ethanol. We also use the fuel that we use is called ethanol. So is ethanol a hydrocarbon?
Yes.
So when I drink wine, I'm drinking a hydrocarbon?
That's correct.
And are all alcohols hydrocarbons?
That's absolutely correct. That they differ in their chemical structure. Normally, the number of carbon atoms they have, but also, there's other structural differences that can come about as well.
So, does that difference determine how they wind up being used? For example, we use it as an antiseptic. We include it in cough syrups. We use it as a solvent for vanilla and perfumes. We use it as a fuel. We use it as something to drink. Is it because we have a different number of carbon and hydrogen molecules that they can do these different things?
Well, again, if we restrict our discussion to just ethanol, so now we're talking about just a single chemical structure. So it can be used, as you said, a fuel, for a number of different things. And all of these properties, all of these characteristics are based solely on its chemical structure. So a lot of the different different uses come about from how concentrated it is. So, for example, as a fuel, normally you would want to use pure alcohol, and then it burns. Whereas if it's diluted in water, then it will no longer burn. For example, if it's diluted down to like 10%. And on the other hand, for drinking, medication purposes. Of course, you could drink pure alcohol, but it's not very palatable in most cases.
I thought vodka was the closest thing to pure alcohol.
It's about 40%. Mm-hmm. But like in wine, that's 10%, and beer it's about 5%. So in those cases, again, it's more palatable. And if we talk about the antiseptic properties, we're more talking about 70% alcohol, and then it inhibits bacterial growth. So many of these differences in properties or characteristics have to do with the concentration of alcohol that we're dealing with. And then we can talk about differences in chemical structure of the different alcohols, and then the concentration-dependent effects, you know, may differ from one structure to another.
Do they all come out of the conversion of sugars into something else?
Right. Generally, that's a common way to produce them from a fermentation process, from yeast, for example.
Now, Dr. Krenzler, Dr. Gonzalez said that the different alcoholic beverages we drink have different percentages of alcohol in them. Is that why we're affected differently by them?
That's the major reason. The notion of a standard drink is often used to try and account for the different alcohol concentrations of different beverages. So a standard drink of spirits like vodka or whiskey is generally considered 1.5 ounces. The standard drink of beer is a 12-ounce can of beer, and the standard drink of wine is a 5-ounce glass of wine. They all contain about 0.6 ounces of ethanol.
So in the end, whether they have a higher or a lower alcoholic content, if we drink them in the normal portions, we're getting pretty much the same amount of alcohol.
Yes. And that's a key concept, the notion that I can drink a lot of beer because I don't get drunk, but I can't drink as much wine or whiskey is really a fallacy. It's all about how much you're drinking of the different concentration of a beverage.
So when you're drinking a six-pack, you're drinking an awful lot of alcohol.
Yep, you're drinking six standard drinks, which is generally enough to get your average individual intoxicated.
My guests are Dr. Henry R. Krenzler, professor of psychiatry and genetics and developmental biology at the University of Connecticut Health Center, and Dr. Ruben Gonzalez, professor of pharmacology and toxicology at the University of Texas, Austin. And we're talking about alcohol on today's Please Explain here on WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leddy Lopate, and we invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. What happens when we ingest alcohol? How does our body process it?
This is Ruben Gonzalez here. So the first thing, I mean, obviously we normally drink it, and it goes into the stomach, into the digestive system, and then from there it gets absorbed into the bloodstream. And from there it gets distributed throughout the entire body. So once alcohol is ingested, it has effects all over the body. Of course, we normally think about it in terms of its intoxicating properties, and those effects are exerted in the brain. But just because it affects the brain and causes intoxication at that point doesn't mean it's not having effects all over the body. So I think that's one key point to keep in mind. But then once it enters the brain, so it gets there within 5-10 minutes, and after a standard drink, as we were talking about earlier, it starts affecting different parts of the brain. And again, it goes all over the brain, so it's really affecting all of the brain, but some functions of the brain are affected at lower concentrations compared to others. So after a single drink, we normally feel effects such as a feeling of well-being, feeling of relaxation, you know, reduction of anxiety, you know, things that we normally think about in terms of
gregariousness, isn't it?
Right. And but then as an individual continues to drink, the concentrations get higher and higher in the brain, again, as well as other parts of the body. But then other centers of the brain become affected, and eventually can lead to things like incoordination and slurred speech. And again, as the concentration continues to increase, so now we're talking of six drinks and even higher, you can get into things like you get severe sedation, and eventually the alcohol can kill you. It in high enough doses, it is a poison, and it can turn off the breathing centers in the brain, and you end up with death. And unfortunately, this does happen.
Now, if we also will apply alcohol to a wound, now we're putting very small quantities there. But in theory, isn't that also going into our bloodstream? Would if enough of that went into the blood, would we be having the same kind of experience, or is it a different alcohol?
Well, it would be the same alcohol. It is ethanol, but yeah, the it's very concentrated, and normally, you know, very little of it gets absorbed through the skin. Mm-hmm. But theoretically, you're correct. If you, you know, dipped your body into alcohol for a long enough period of time, enough alcohol would be absorbed to cause intoxication, but of course that's very impractical.
Now, Dr. Kranzler, can you explain why it's been claimed in recent years that the consumption of alcohol in moderation can have a positive health benefit?
It's predominantly related to cardiovascular risk. There's evidence that there's what's called a J-shaped curve in relation to cardiovascular risk, so that people who don't drink at all have a modestly increased risk relative to those who drink moderately. But at the other extreme, where there's heavy drinking, you actually have increased cardiovascular risk. And so alcohol's effects can be understood as a family of curves. The cardiovascular curve is J-shaped, but most other risk curves are just straight upward lines, so that the more you drink, the more risk there is. But cardiovascular risk is a major health risk in the U.S. for certain, and industrialized countries generally. And so that outweighs any of the other effects, say, on breast cancer risk, which is elevated with any drinking, or risk of cirrhosis of the liver, which is also elevated directly in relation to the dose of alcohol consumed.
So if you drink in moderation, it can actually keep your cardiovascular system going well. But even then, there's a difference between men and women in that regard?
I think that the benefits...
Because you talked about breast cancer.
Well, the cardiovascular risk, I think, is evident in both sexes. The other risk factors that are related to drinking differ by sex, and so the counterbalancing downside risk of drinking is somewhat different by sex. But I think the cardiovascular protective effects are present both in men and women. Women are protected by estrogen at least until the menopause, and so that's another confounder, if you will, in terms of understanding the effects of alcohol.
Well, what's known about why some people seem more vulnerable to others, not only to getting high, but also to becoming addicted to alcohol?
Well, we know that that's true.
Do we metabolize alcohol differently?
Yeah, there's some difference in innate metabolic clearance, but there's mostly a difference in the ability to manage alcohol at a similar blood alcohol concentration between people. And so the intoxicating effects, so it's largely CNS, central nervous system mediated. The tolerance, that the initial tolerance that people demonstrate is largely a function of what their brain can manage in the context of alcohol, rather than any metabolic difference.
Are some people genetically predisposed one way or the other?
Absolutely.
So, by the way, a very vehement chemist just called. He wanted to say alcohol is not a hydrocarbon. But from my research, it seems to be. It's hydrogen and carbon, isn't it?
Yes, I'm not sure why anyone would object to that. It's a classic hydrocarbon.
Well, why does that have an effect on our brains? We were talking about what happens when it starts generalizing around the brain, but why does it alter the way we perceive things?
First,
in a very mild way, but if we drink enough, as you say, in a way that really can have very powerful effects on the way we think, the way we talk, our ability to remain balanced.
Yes, I mean that's a really great question, and this has been studied for many years, and to try to boil it down, alcohol is a very small molecule, and it's very unique in terms in that respect when we compare it to other drugs. So it is a drug, and when we think about normal medical drugs that we take, these are very large molecules, and since alcohol is a very small molecule, one, it goes all over the body, as I said, all over the brain, but we also need very large quantities for it to have an effect. So even though it goes all over the brain, ultimately its effects are due to changes in function at the cellular and molecular level. So those cells of the brain that create its normal function, so our thoughts, feelings, etc., that we normally carry out, are due to cellular activity. And so when alcohol enters the brain, at the molecular level, it interacts with certain molecular targets on these cells, and therefore alter its function. So,
well, it disinhibits. It's a disinhibitor, isn't it?
Well, we can talk about that in terms of how brain circuits work, and but again, because it's such a small molecule, it generally goes everywhere, and it has effects on different molecular targets, and some at lower concentrations compared to other concentrations,
and regional differences, as Ruben pointed out before, regions of the brain. So early effects are the disinhibiting effects are probably cortical, and they remove some of the inhibitions that our cortices normally impose on our behavior, and later effects are more posterior brain. Ultimately, the fatal effects are brainstem effects. That's where the breathing center is located. By the way,
so we don't want to drink enough to get to our brainstem.
Well, it does get to your brainstem. You don't want to drink enough that it knocks your brainstem out.
Mm.
Brainstem is a good thing. It keeps you alive.
We have to take a break, and we'll come back after we have a little breathing room and talk more about alcohol with my guest, Dr. Henry R. Kranzler, professor of psychiatry and genetics and developmental biology at the University of Connecticut Health Center, Dr. Ruben Gonzalez, professor of pharmacology and toxicology at the University of Texas in Austin, and we will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. But first this. Back to Please Explain, and my guests, Dr. Ruben Gonzalez of the University of Texas in Austin and Dr. Henry R. Kranzler of the University of Connecticut Health Center, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Let's get right to some of those calls. We begin with Ben from Brooklyn.
Hello there.
Yeah, hi, Ben.
My question was this. Is there any scientific or medical basis for the folklore of various drinks affecting people's personality in different ways? For example, gin being sort of a depressant and tequila being maybe an upper and bourbon making you feel mellow, etc. And if there's time, my other question is, what are the medical and scientific processes that are going on when you have a hangover?
I'd be happy to try and answer the first question. I think there's very little, there's no evidence that different beverages have those kinds of different effects. But there is very good evidence that people's expectations of what an alcoholic beverage might do to them are very powerful in terms of influencing their behavior.
Do you think that is to some degree determined by the taste? So bourbon may taste more mellow than something else that would have a sharper taste?
It could, but obviously taste is a very variable experience. So I suspect that those have some basis in everyday expectations. I'm not sure where they arose from, but I don't think there's a scientific basis for it.
And Dr. Gonzalez, what about hangovers?
I'm
glad he got that one.
I'll have to speculate a little bit here because we don't really, it's difficult to study hangover in general, but we do know that alcohol is a diuretic, and particularly, you know, bouts of extensive drinking will cause dehydration. And so, you know, even the cells in your brain get dehydrated, and so that can lead to some of the effects of hangover. But there's probably some other effects as well. It's well known that alcohol withdrawal from alcohol just also causes, you know, other effects on the brain and the body. So, so again, you know, we don't have a great understanding, but some of these effects may contribute.
Let's take another call. We go now to Bill from Peekskill. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I've often wondered why alcohol is such a good sterilizer for skin and other surfaces, and I was wondering if any of your guests could approach that subject and try and explain what's going on there.
Yeah, why does it kill germs, and does it kill germs when we're drinking it as beer or wine?
Yeah, I'll tackle that one. So it doesn't kill germs as beer or wine because the concentrations are too low.
But we see it sometimes in a cough medicine, don't we?
Right, but that's not for antiseptic purposes. That's to say the truth, I'm not exactly sure why it's in cough medicine.
Although it makes you feel good.
I'm sure it's not for the antiseptic purposes.
It makes it soluble. It makes everything soluble. It's a wonderful solubilizer.
Right. So again, it's not for the antiseptic properties. But in terms of how it kills germs, part of the reason, again, probably has to do with its dehydrating properties at the cellular level. And again, it probably won't kill the germs so much as just inhibit them from growing. And so from that standpoint, you know, it's still helpful for, you know, for reducing the risk of infection.
Now, we do feel a stinging sensation when we put alcohol on the cut. We don't feel it with hydrogen peroxide.
Right, right. And so, again, that has to do with the direct effects of alcohol on the nerve endings. And I'm not exactly sure how it stimulates those pain nerve endings, but again, it could be partly due to the local dehydrating effects.
Now, Dr. Krenzel, you mentioned that it's also a very good solvent, and it's used as a solvent and a preservative. It's used in perfume as a solvent. It's used in making vanilla, the liquid vanilla, as a solvent. What is it about alcohol that allows it to do that?
Well, the chemical structure is such that it's very hydrophilic, meaning it likes water. And
although it boils at a lower temperature, doesn't it?
Yes, but that's also a function of the different chemical structures and the fact. The miscibility of alcohol, the fact that it mixes very readily with water, is partly why it has effects on bacteria. But I think also it coagulates proteins, and that bacteria may be susceptible to some effects, actual chemical changes in proteins, in addition to potentially dehydrating them.
We go now to Sean from Bradley Beach. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing? You sort of answered some of the question before, but I guess it's maybe urban myth that if you drink water just after you start drinking, and I'm talking a lot of water, or while you're drinking, or coffee after you drink, you start to feel the effects, you feel fewer effects of the alcohol drinking. Is that just an urban myth, or is it the alcohol being a diuretic and you add water and it definitely takes away some of the edge, or is that just bull?
Well, again, I'm not sure that there are any controlled studies about this, but as you said, it certainly makes sense. Since you're losing body water during the drinking bout, it makes sense if you replace it, you're gonna reduce the effects of the dehydration.
You're also going to excrete some alcohol in your urine, because water is a great diuretic.
And then another issue, I think, which is often overlooked, is in terms of drinking water, either directly after a bout or even, you know, during a bout, if you intersperse an alcoholic beverage with a glass of water, then you're actually lowering the concentration of alcohol in your body, one, by allowing its metabolism, but then also by reducing the continuous intake. So there's probably several mechanisms there, and so there's probably some truth to that.
Now, what makes alcohol addictive, and how does it compare to other kinds of substances that are addictive? Does it go to the same receptors that marijuana, cocaine, and the opiates go to?
Well, it doesn't bind to any receptors per se. There are no alcohol receptors in the brain. Alcohol, as Ruben pointed out, is a small molecule. It gets into cells pretty readily and probably affects receptors indirectly, but doesn't bind. What probably makes alcohol addictive, and a variety of drugs that are self-administered for their reinforcing effects, is their capacity to release dopamine in a portion of the brain called the medial forebrain bundle, which has been linked to pleasure. Now, that's undoubtedly a bit simplified because there's more that goes on there than just dopamine, but there is some consistency in the literature showing that different drugs, heroin, nicotine, alcohol, all influence dopamine release to increase it in that part of the brain. One other thing, by the way, alcohol is not a very potent drug in the sense of you need large doses of alcohol. When you think about the dosage that's required to intoxicate someone, it's in the grams or even hundreds of grams, whereas a drug like morphine is intoxicating in a milligram, a thousandth the dose, if you will. And there are other drugs, fentanyl, other opiates, synthetic opiates, that are even more potent. So alcohol is not a very potent drug, but people consume large enough volumes of it that it can at times kill them.
A listener has written in this question: why does drinking disturb your sleep later in the night?
Yeah, that's another good question. So alcohol clearly, again, has effects in many parts of the brain, and one of the parts of the brain is the clock, or the part of the brain that helps you distinguish, night and day. And so obviously that influences sleep patterns. And again, just in general, during sleep, your brain is active, and although we're not conscious of it, but recent evidence suggests that this activity during sleep is critical for normal function during the day. And so alcohol, by altering the ability of these circuits, these cells to communicate with each other, and they're altering the circuit activity and overall brain activity, so you're disrupting the normal function of sleep. And so that has effects, later on down the line.
Let's take another call. This one is from Samuel from Manhattan. Hi, Samuel. You're on the air. Sam, you have to turn off your radio because you're hearing us in delay.
I'm sorry. Good afternoon. How does the alcohol benefit the cardiovascular system? What does it do? How does it benefit?
That's a good question. It has a number of different effects that may be responsible. What it appears to do is increase high-density lipoproteins, which are also increased by things like exercise, and those tend to scavenge cholesterol remove them from the playing field so that they can't cause plaque in the vasculature. It also is a blood thinner, if you will, so it may reduce the risk of thrombosis, clots, it may also have effects on prostaglandins, I believe, and may be beneficial in that regard, too, in terms of thrombosis.
Now, we heard that red wine was more effective than white at one point. Then I heard that white wine was okay as well. Again, we're talking moderation. But are there certain things in the different wines that have more of an impact?
Well, resveratrol has been isolated from wine. I think it's found in higher content in red wine than white wine, though I'm not absolutely certain.
And now they're actually offering it as a separate drug, aren't
they? Right. You can get resveratrol capsules, I believe.
Easier for you to say.
Yeah. Resveratrol seems to have some of the beneficial effects, but it's clear that alcoholic beverages, irrespective of which ones, have cardiovascular beneficial effects.
Lois from New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I have two questions. The first one is, since alcohol is a small molecule and seems to affect all of the all parts of the brain, have there ever been any studies using alcohol as a treatment for, well, not a treatment, but a means of getting a treatment to a brain tumor?
I've never heard of that, no.
Okay.
No, I haven't heard that either.
Well, if somebody's out there who's thinking about other ways of getting to certain hard-to-get-to cells in the brain, maybe this might be the perfect medium. And what was the other question, Lois?
The other one was, if you're a recovering alcoholic and you've abstained for many, many years, and you take up one drink, it seems to affect the body much more greatly than somebody who is not an alcoholic. Is there a reason for that?
If that's true, and there certainly is some evidence that that's the case, but it's a bit controversial. It probably has a lot to do with the expectation of the effects and probably the frequent pairing of drinking behavior with desired effects. So it's a learned effect that's been reinforced hundreds, perhaps thousands of times.
And this is why some people will tell you that you can go back to drinking if you have overcome your alcoholism, and others say you can never go back.
Right. It's a controversial area for sure.
Well,
I think the safest approach is not to drink at all, though.
You mean for all of us not to drink?
No, for people who have had serious problems with drinking.
I want to thank the two of you so much for being on our show today. Dr. Henry R. Kranzler is professor of psychology and genetics and developmental biology at the University of Connecticut Health Center, and Dr. Ruben Gonzalez, professor of pharmacology and toxicology at the University of Texas in Austin. It's been a pleasure to have you on Please Explain.
Thanks for having you.
Monday marks the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and we'll be speaking with two of the foremost experts on Soviet and Eastern European affairs, Stephen Kotkin and Stephen Cohn, to start off our show. And then Thelma Schoonmaker, Martin Scorsese's longtime editor, and Michael Powell's widow, discusses the restoration of the Red Shoes, which Powell made in 1948. Also, baritone Thomas Hampson on being named the New York Philharmonic's first artist in residence, and the Kinks lead singer Ray Davis on his solo career. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Drew Katchen, Ida Sadr-Kiani, Miranda Schaefer, and contributing producer Bonnie LaFave. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you on Monday.